by John Aldiss. This is BBC Radio 3. It's 9:45, and now in this week's Sunday feature, Matthew Sweet explores the extraordinary life, thinking and influence of Wilhelm Reich, whose idea of sexual revolution helped to shape the 60s. But he died in prison in America, his books banned and burned.
I'm on the road to Organon, a high, cold place on the edge of America, where one of the most controversial thinkers of the modern era came to pursue his experiments into the fundamental forces of the universe and the transformation of the human consciousness. These were the ideas that drove Wilhelm Reich, psychoanalyst, sexual revolutionary, 20th century man of destiny. They drove him from the consulting rooms of Vienna to exile in New York and eventually to here, a lonely, snowy stretch of upstate Maine. There are pine trees all around me here. This is moose country too. The snow is coming down, and somewhere, not far away, is the laboratory on top of a hill. So who was Wilhelm Reich? The answer to that lies up ahead, in Organon.
It is April 3rd, 1952, at Organon, Rangeley, Maine. I, Wilhelm Reich, am sitting alone in the large room in the lower house. All people are gone.
So up we go. It's a winding road. And here it is. Here it is. The observatory. I was driven up the hill to Organon by Mary Higgins, who's been director of the Wilhelm Reich Infant Trust for over half a century.
It's designed by a New York architect, but very much to Reich's specifications. And he's the one that insisted on the wood.
This is an amazing space. Because it's all wooden, there's a sort of burnished feel about it. And inside it are the technological paraphernalia of Reich's work. Over here, there's this amazing machine. That's a cloud buster, isn't it, over there in the corner, Mary?
Yes, it is.
Organon was the site of Reich's last stand, but he was born in 1897 in a snowy tract of the Austro-Hungarian Empire that's since been swallowed up by Ukraine. A chill went through his childhood too. Reich's father was a domestic tyrant. Adultery was his mother's secret form of rebellion. Suicide, her permanent escape. Reich blamed himself for the tragedy. At the end of the First World War, he washed up in Vienna with few connections and less cash. And yet, by the 1920s, he was right at the heart of Viennese intellectual life, the evidence for which is nailed to the wall at Organon.
It's a picture of Freud, and it's given to Reich by Freud.
So the inscription, is that in Freud's handwriting?
Mm-hmm. It says, "With friendly memories from Sigmund Freud, March 1925. To Herrn Dr. Wilhelm Reich."
So Reich was in Freud's close orbit, but that isn't where he stayed. Dr. Harry Lewis is a therapist who trained with one of Reich's team from Organon. He told me how Reich challenged Freud's idea that sexual repression was a sad social necessity.
Roughly, you know, around the time that Freud and the group around Freud begin to present masochism as a primary and inevitable element of human structure, leading to the establishment of what Freud called the death instinct. Reich led a full frontal assault on that premise, saying there was no indication that it was a natural instinctual impulse. And then not only that, that the goal of life was to be a fully free pulsating organism.
In 1930, Reich moved to Berlin, where his abhorrence of sexual repression became coupled with his growing interest in communist politics. He lectured, he marched, he campaigned, and he gave young, confused Berliners radical advice about sex.
He was telling them they had a right to their feelings. and that there was nothing terrible about this, and that, for instance, if they masturbated, they weren't going to go crazy, all of these different things, and that if they had girlfriends at a certain age, you know, when a certain age, that was fine if they protected themselves. In other words, he was way ahead on that. But what he was really saying is that, in a funny way, protect your capacity to love.
But in the Berlin of 1931, hate was in the air. In the German parliament, Reich's fellow communists shouted down the speaker, a Nazi. Reich was ethnically Jewish, a psychoanalyst and a communist who didn't just want a Marxist revolution, but a sexual revolution too. And then the Reichstag and Germany were Hitler's, which put Reich in terrible danger.
He was persecuted. His friends were being hauled out of their beds in the middle of the night. Two of his friends were tortured and killed in a police cell. And he finally left Germany when his name appeared in a Nazi newspaper on a kind of wanted list.
Historian Christopher Turner, author of a new study of Reich and his impact. Reich's ideas were everything that Nazism feared and despised, but he used those ideas to analyse the mind of the German nation and explain why Nazi thinking had blossomed there. And he wrote it down in a highly original book called The Mass Psychology of Fascism.
What the book tried to work through was why on earth had communism not managed to stop fascism. You know, he'd fought very hard on the streets as part of the Communist Party. And the book looked quite harshly at the communists themselves. You know, he had been slightly marginalised in the Communist Party because of his sexual theories. He basically argues that if his sexual theories had been adopted by the Communist Party, they would have been able to withstand the fascists.
I've got a copy of The Mass Psychology of Fascism here, and it contains this very powerful idea. Sexual repression, the authoritarian nature of German domestic life, this is what paved Hitler's path to power. And he says, the sexual effect of a uniform, the erotically provocative effect of rhythmically executed goose-stepping, the exhibitionistic nature of militaristic procedures have been more practically comprehended by a salesgirl or an average secretary than by our most erudite politicians. Well, the erudite politicians who had marched with Reich didn't take that one on the chin.
He'd been thrown out of the psychoanalytic movement because he was a communist. And he'd been thrown out of the Communist Party essentially because he was a psychoanalyst, because he was interested in sex.
And here comes one of the ideas that would dominate Reich's life, the orgasm. The orgasm was vital, energetic, a kind of explosive force. As Mary Higgins told me, Reich began to see the orgasm as something that might help people to conquer their neurotic diseases.
The observation that he'd made as a clinician of the importance of the discharge of what that time he referred to as sexual energy, in the patient's capacity to be better, was very important. That wasn't just someone's idea about something. He could see it.
What was it about the event of the orgasm that made it seem like the key idea, the key event that needed to be studied?
Because it was the most sort of cleansing discharge of energy. In other words, the function of what Reich called orgastic potency, and that was not what is usually considered as potency, was that whatever excess energy had developed, if it could be discharged really in the orgasm, then there was none of this sort of stale energy stuck there. And that, as far as he was concerned, was creating the source of these diseases.
In exile in Scandinavia, Reich's ideas about the orgasm took him out of the therapist's consulting room and into the lab. He'd moved beyond psychology and into another realm altogether.
Could you actually show that there was an actual physical charge? And using an oscillograph, he showed how a charge could be measured at the surface of the skin. So there was an actual energy there.
But again, Reich's radicalism brought him hostile attention.
He was thrown out of Denmark, and then he moved to Sweden. He was thrown out of Sweden, all because they were suspicious of his sexual theories. They thought he was perverting youth. They saw him as some kind of Socrates corrupting the young. So By the time he got to Norway, he really was a cornered man. And he describes in one very beautiful passage of his diary how fascism was waiting at the edges of Europe like a cat pouncing to catch its victim.
Reich was on the last boat out of Norway before Europe descended into war. When he arrived in New York in August 1939, he did exactly what I'm doing now. He stood on Broadway and 42nd Street and goggled at the neon, all that energy pulsing around him and lighting up the night. You might have expected Reich to be sceptical about this country. Actually, it filled him with optimism. But he might not have been so hopeful had he known the fate that would befall him here. Reich arguably exerted more influence upon American culture than the culture of any other country in the world. But this is also the country that destroyed him.
Part of what I think people miss is just how important Reich was when he arrived in the United States. His lectures at the New School were standing room only, literally. I mean, there were hundreds and hundreds of people gathering.
The last therapist Reich ever trained was Dr. Morton Herskovitz. He's now in his 90s and living in Philadelphia and still practicing. He told me how he first encountered Reich's work.
At the time, I was courting a girl whose father was very widely read. And I was, at the time, interested in going into psychoanalysis. And he once said to me, "What do you think of Wilhelm Reich?" So I said, "Oh, he's a nut." He said, "Why do you say that?" I said, "Everyone knows he's just a nut." He said, "Have you ever read anything that he wrote?" I said, "No." He said, "Don't you think before you call a man a nut, you could at least have some basis for your opinion?" So I knew he was correct. And at the time, I'd been taking courses in psychoanalysis. But when I read the first book that I was going to read to prove my point that Reich was a nut, there were the answers that I was looking for from my teacher in analysis.
That book was called The Sexual Revolution, and to Dr. Herskovitz's delight, it argued, for example, that the Oedipus complex was cultural, not universal. He raided Reich's back catalogue, digested its contents, then plucked up the courage to ask if he could go into therapy with Reich himself.
He was coming down the stairs, and I was sitting by his desk. And my first impression was, this is a powerful guy. He was big, he was hefty, and he had a sense of power, as one observed him.
What was the nature of that power, do you think? Was this something physical as well as intellectual?
No, it was physical. It was as if one were observing thunder.
At this point, it was an energy in the atmosphere that was obsessing Reich, the same charge that he'd detected buzzing on the surface of the skin, the charge released at the moment of orgasm, and he gave it a name, orgone. And he shared it with his readers in one of his most influential books, The Function of the Orgasm. He says, "The living organism contains orgone energy in each one of its cells and continuously charges itself organotically from the atmosphere by means of respiration." He was taking an idea from biology and pursuing it into the field of physics. Orgone therapist Dr. Harry Lewis.
If one simply looks up at the sky on a clear day and open your eyes, you can see pulsation and movement in the atmosphere, and that's orgone energy. Think of yourself on a day when you're feeling really free and open. You feel the energy pulsing in you. That's just your natural energy. You want to call it life energy, vital energy, or orgone energy. That's what orgone energy is. When I talk about orgone energy, it is real to me. It is not something that I believe exists or feel. It's something I've observed, I've seen, I've worked with specifically, and I actually can manipulate and see the effects of that on myself as well as on patients, as well as on amoebas that I've observed. It is a scientific, evidentiary-based fact. Now, whether that scientific evidentiary fact can be questioned or doubted or disproven remains to be seen.
There are very few scientists working today who take a serious interest in orgone. But that idea that the free flow of energy through the body is a key to happiness, to liberation, turned out to be one of the most potent ideas of the 20th century. What kept people repressed and miserable, Reich argued, was something not just mental, but muscular. He called it armour. I asked Morten Herskovits to explain.
To Reich, it was so clear that tight-necked people were obstinate, that dull-eyed people were removed from the environment, that tight-bellied people were anxious. And he was the first psychiatrist to use that knowledge in effecting the therapy that he practiced.
So emotional repression then is situated in the body as well as in the mind.
Exactly.
So how does Reichian therapy set out to resolve the problem of armouring, to kind of break that carapace?
For example, if a patient has a tight neck, I press on the muscles in the neck until it's painful. And I instruct the patient to yell and to yell at me, to just yell at God, to express all the anger that's held in that neck. And when they do it, they experience a great deal of relief. So that in the course of therapy, patients yell, they punch and kick and scream, they cry, they laugh, and some of them develop a deep, honest laughter that they never had in their lives.
There were two kinds of people who were interested in Reich's ideas: his own team of researchers, therapists and followers, and a larger coalition of radicals, anarchists and proto-beatniks who devoured his work with promiscuous enthusiasm, as Christopher Turner explains.
He was selling 400 or 500 books a week. It was amazing. And he said that his books in California were selling like warm bread.
It wasn't just the idea of orgone energy that resonated with these readers. Reich had also constructed an apparatus that he said could collect and concentrate this force, the orgone accumulator. In the Reich Museum at Organon, Mary Higgins showed me one.
Well, this is an orgone accumulator which is made in the size so that a person can sit in it. It looks like a box. It's three-sided and then a door in the front, obviously. This is a three-layer accumulator. In other words, there are three layers of metallic material and non-metallic, metallic, etc. in these walls.
So there's sandwiched layers of organic and inorganic material.
That's right. Always with the inorganic on the inside, because the metals attract and also immediately diffuse the energy.
And the patient, the occupant, would sit on
there's a board or a little stool in the beginning. You just put a chair in there. That's right. Some people feel it very quickly. Some people do not.
What kind of sensations do patients report inside the accumulator?
A tingling sensation. You can sometimes feel a lot. And, of course, warmth. And can you feel? I feel
I'm not
that.
Sure. I'm putting my hand in front of the interior of the door. I feel I can feel a sort of a coldness from the metal.
Now I feel, you know, a sort of a tingling in my hand. I feel it's getting stronger. But it varies.
I'm not getting anything, I must say.
That's right. But see, my hand is tingling. I can feel it. But also, I'm used to it. You know, I use an accumulator. Not as often as I should.
And what benefits have you derived from it, do you think?
I tend to use it when I'm very tired. And it's helps a lot. With burns, or say with a cut, you can see it very quickly. For instance, if you burn your finger on the stove or something like that, I always just run for my accumulator, because there will be immediately a sort of, almost immediately, a more intense pain. But then after that, no pain, and it doesn't blister.
In 1947, Reich was the subject of sceptical, even hostile articles in the press, and it was the accumulator that became Exhibit A in the case against him. It aroused the suspicions of the Food and Drug Administration, who launched an investigation into his activities at Organon. Reich vehemently denied their allegations of medical fraudulence, and all this bad publicity made him both better known and more isolated.
This is a recording by Reich himself, right after a conference here at Organon, and he's really just putting something on record that he feels very deeply.
I hope that someone will, at some time in the future, listen to this recording with great respect. Respect for the courage that was necessary to sustain the research work in Organon Energy and Life Energy all through these years.
Now, who is it a message to?
I don't see it as being a message to anybody, but just a need of his own to express this reality. As the work moves further and further beyond the ordinary and where people are, he's more and more alone.
He felt cornered. He was up in Maine. He was being persecuted, pursued. The FDA were after him. The FBI were after him. The immigration services were after him. It all seemed to be closing in. And his disciples started to leave. He was really isolated and desperate. And I think his ideas started taking on a bit of an eccentric turn at that point. But one can understand his paranoia and desperation.
So there's a narrower staircase here with a metal banister. Photographs of space on the wall, galaxies.
Mary Higgins took me to the summit of Reich's observatory. He'd begun by detecting orgone energy in the human body. By the end, he was looking for it in the stars.
Oh, there's a sort of trapdoor.
It's not, we're just trying to protect the heat.
Oh, it's the foam panel.
No.
Right, so we bend down and get in here. It's rather like coming into an Egyptian tomb, this.
Okay.
Oh, so. So we're right at the top of the building now.
Reich hoped to have a large telescope, so this would have been the base for it. And this was just to protect the building, only the telescope never happened.
But were there telescopes up here, smaller telescopes?
Yeah, here's this telescope.
I can hear the wind.
You'll hear it all right.
There's a letter on the wall here that Reich sent to the people who were going to build him the telescope that was never put in here, but his specifications are here, and he also says why he wants it. Our main purpose in the purchase of a telescope is the observation of the atmosphere of the planets and the sun's corona, if possible also of farther celestial objects. Are there any provisions at the telescope for attachment of photographic apparatus? Kindly send us all the details.
Orgone was everywhere in the atmosphere. He thought that he could use orgone energy to control the weather, and then later to fight UFOs. And I think what unites all those things really is this kind of like cadence of mood that you see in Reich's life. If you read his letters, you will see that he has manic episodes and then depressive episodes. And certainly his daughter told me that she thought that he was manic depressive. She said, "Is there any doubt?" And I think in Reich's life, you get these manic phases where he has all these ideas and he feels that he's making discoveries and there's this tremendous energy. And then he has these depressive moments where he consolidates those theories and incorporates them into his already existing ideas. So there is an amazing coherence in his thought. And it's interesting to try and follow that.
But what is it? Is there a unifying idea? Is an idea that all of these areas have in common?
Orgone energy.
Oh, wow. So, we're coming out onto the flat roof of the observatory here. And the air is so clean.
Yeah. That's Mount Washington. And this down here, that's Rangeley Lake. There's a lot of water.
Up on that observation deck, gazing out over that vast wintry landscape, I felt as if I was on the top of the world. Perhaps Reich felt that too. But by 1954, his ascent was over. He was issued with an injunction that prohibited him from distributing accumulators and publishing on the subject of orgone energy. He gave his defiant reply in an extraordinary series of documents, one of which is called Atoms for Peace versus the Hig, the hoodlums in government. Mary Higgins explained his view.
The idea that you go in and a judge decides whether this is true or not, this is insane. The court is caught in a peculiar situation, and yet they're in a situation where they should never have been in the first place, and Reich was right.
I think reading this statement of his, you get a real sense of how embattled he was, too. I mean, the language that he uses, it's interesting, he writes about himself in the third person as well, which makes it, transforms your sense of it, too. The discoverer of the life energy decided that this was the last time Higgs would dare to try to kill a discovery and the discoverer. This time it would be resisted, lest all future discoverers be subject to the threat that anyone who disliked them could drag the hard worker in science into court on a fraud charge. It does not matter here whether the drug agencies acted in a bona fide way or not. They acted as executive organs of a basic evil and had to be stopped.
Yeah,
it's tremendously powerful, isn't it?
It's very powerful. It's very powerful. And, you know, if there's one thing I think that has been proved since Reich's death, and certainly there's been very little, if any, very little scientific work done, and et cetera, et cetera. But I think the trust has proved the validity of Reich's initial position.
Well, the stakes were so high,
The stakes were his work. And as he said, he would not let anybody get into that. You know, not he just wasn't. He would virtually kill to protect that. And actually, he carried guns around here, and he would not talk to the FDA agents.
So the estate that we're on now, Organon, during that period, I mean, was it almost like was it literally besieged then?
Yeah.
Finally, Reich and one of his close colleagues were tried for breaching the injunction. Reich was sentenced to 2 years in the Lewisburg Penitentiary in Pennsylvania. Morton Herskovitz was there to see his mentor in the dock, and he sensed that this was the end.
I thought putting Reich in prison is like putting an eagle in a cage, and I thought this may be his end, and it was.
Do you remember hearing of his death?
Yeah. His death was pretty close to the time that he was up for parole. And I assumed that Reich was going to be paroled. And it was just a couple of weeks before that time that he died of a heart attack.
Reich was dead, and the authorities had done their best to kill his work too. They'd ruled that the orgone accumulator was a fake. But bizarrely, they also chose to regard Reich's writings on the subject of orgone as a form of inaccurate commercial labelling. So not only were the accumulators smashed, but his literature was destroyed.
Oh, that was a terrible period. To see books that one valued so highly go into an incinerator in the United States was regarded as almost scandalous.
Actually, it's right here. It's going to be tight, Charlie.
And this is where the books were burned. 6 tons of them hoiked into the flames in the incinerator of the New York Sanitation Department in the meatpacking district of Manhattan. I'm looking at the building now where I think this all happened. It's a great square brick block with the sanitation department's name written across the top of it. It's a pretty grim building. And it's in this building that a life's work went up in smoke by the water on the banks of the Hudson. The sexual revolution, the mass psychology, the fascism. It was the funeral of Reich's career, really. The smokestacks here on Gansevoort Street sent Reich's literary remains up into the air above New York. But his ideas were already in the atmosphere of the culture.
His ideas had a second wave of interest precisely because he was imprisoned and his books were burnt.
the Sydney Libertarians treated the sexual revolution as a sacred text. I mean, it was burnt ceremonially in the United States, and that'd be another reason why we loved it.
Norman Mailer was one of the preeminent people in promoting Reich's ideas, and he felt ashamed that his generation had done so little to help Reich.
I worked at the Village Voice at that time. Everybody read and knew and referenced Reich.
And in the Village Voice, after Reich's death, he started publishing articles, basically promoting Reich's ideas. And it started one of Mailer's contemporaries called the Great Orgasm Debate, which raged in beds all over New York and America.
Bill Burroughs kept an orgone accumulator, and Lord knows what he did in it. But for better or worse, Reich's ideas permeate Burroughs' creations.
It was the power of those ideas that sexual emancipation would stop rigid mass conformity.
In post-war culture, Reichian ideas surface in all sorts of surprising places. In 1956, Saul Bellow published a novella called Seize the Day, set in the shabby genteel world of the hotels of Upper Broadway. Bellow's Tommy Wilhelm is a feckless 40-something who feels trapped and suffocated by his relationship with his elderly father. I'm on my way now to meet Saul Bellow's biographer, James Atlas.
Bellow was among a world of intellectuals and writers in New York who were all trying to deal with these ideas that were in the air and to somehow liberate themselves from what they felt were constrained marriages and lives that they had. Bellow actually had an orgone box in one of his residences in Queens, and he spent long hours in this reading and screaming and gnawing on his handkerchief. And he also saw a Reichian therapist.
Is Seize the Day the first place where Reich's ideas make an incursion into Bellow's work?
Yes, it is. This is the book in which Tommy Wilhelm, a struggling character who is going through a major midlife crisis, in one day loses the last of his money and has a terrible confrontation with his father. Do you want me to comfort you for having such a son? Wilhelm had a great knot of wrong tied tight within his chest, and tears approached his eyes, but he didn't let them out. He looked shabby enough as it was. His voice was thick and hazy, and he was stammering and could not bring his awful feelings forth. Well, one of the words that occurs to me is congestion, right? There's this Reichian, isn't that a Reichian term?
The blockage.
The blockage and congestion, and this is what Tommy is trying to get out, and which he does in the climactic last scene. Reich appears in his life and in his work for quite a number of years. What he found so fascinating and both comic and real about Reich was this idea of character armor.
So we've heard about how Reich's ideas took root in American intellectual culture in the 1950s. How did they get to Britain in the 1960s? Well, I've got here some evidence of one way in which they travelled. This is the unpublished typescript of a biography of Reich, written by the British critic and writer and consummate man of the 60s, Kenneth Tynan. As far as I'm aware, barely anybody has read this. It's certainly not been published, and it's been very kindly lent to us by the Tynan family. And it was through Reich's book, The Sexual Revolution, that Tynan became acquainted with his work. And he says, I first read it during the mid-1950s in New York, and for me, nothing sums up that period in American history more vividly than the fact that in order to obtain a copy, I had to pay a grotesquely inflated price to a pornographic bookseller. The title alone, I suppose, proclaimed the work as both subversive and obscene. It is indeed subversive, but in a more profound sense than that invoked by Senator McCarthy supporters. And I would certainly call it a seminal book if the adjective did not lay itself open to prankish misinterpretation. Although most of it was written more than four decades ago, its findings are far more radical than the vaguely liberal set of ethical proposals that goes by the passive name of permissiveness. If read with a receptive mind in comparative youth,
it still retains the power to change one's life. And I think once you know that all of this was in his head, it helps explain how Reichen formed the idea of the permissive society and the sexual revolution that was had such currency in the 1960s.
Reich described the authoritarian compulsive family as part and parcel and at the same time prerequisite of the authoritarian state and of authoritarian society.
Germaine Greer, reading from The Female Eunuch, the groundbreaking bestseller that changed women's lives. In the very early 60s, before she moved to England and wrote that book, Greer was part of a group of hardline libertarians in Sydney for whom Reich was a household god. I asked her about Reich's thesis that the authoritarian state is a product of the authoritarian family. What did they make of that idea?
Taken on board, absolutely. I can remember us having discussions where we talked about the patriarchal family as the essential underpinning of the patriarchal state and of the whole notion of the father who lays down the law, who invents the discipline which defines the social group and so on. But we would have got it all mixed up as well with Engels and Marx.
And this is an idea that's legible in The Female Eunuch.
Yes, it is. The rejection of the patriarchal family, the rejection more than anything of the nuclear family.
Where now do you see the influence of Reich upon The Female Eunuch?
Probably in its elaboration of the idea of what the intact female would be like. And even the very notion that what makes women biddable is a kind of mental castration, that they end up denying their sexual autonomy and imagining their own sexuality is produced in response to male demand, so that they hardly dare articulate any desire of their own or admit that they've ever felt any desire of their own.
There's a moment when you speak about the repression being legible in the faces of women, and that strikes me as being an idea that might have its roots in Reich, where he talks about how you can see people weighed down, you can see somehow their status reflected in the way their bones are hanging.
Reich was convinced that you would see the outward expression of inward repression in body language, and I would have taken that on board, but I think I was aware from the time I was very small that my mother was a woman of terrific energy with absolutely nothing to do with it, and it was tearing her to bits. It was whirling around inside her brain, inside her heart. She was subject to wild rages that were dangerous. Once nearly poked my eye out on a day when I was going to school, and I couldn't go to school because I had such a massive shine, I had to stay home, because she would have been done for child abuse. She didn't actually abuse me any more than other children were abused. We were all beaten in those days. But she used to go, they were often completely irrational. And I knew, I could see that in her. And I was determined, you know, that it wasn't going to happen to me.
In 1964, Time published an article in which they called Reich a prophet, because America has become one big orgone box. And what they meant by that was that everywhere, you know, in popular culture, you know, in books and films, everywhere was the message that sex will liberate you and libido will make you free. And Reich would have been horrified by that.
And what about in terms of social mores as well? Because 10 years after his death, the phrase sexual revolution is absolutely everywhere, isn't it? And yet it's one that he coined decades before.
Yeah, he coined it, but he was not for sexual wildness that exists so often now. He hoped for a sexual revolution that was combined with empathy, with feelings of love.
So Reich probably wouldn't have approved of the 60s version of his sexual revolution, but because his ideas had inspired it, they also became the object of satire once the permissive society had become something of a joke. Reich had struggled hard to rebut the notion that the orgone accumulator was a sexual device, but the association had stuck. Christopher Turner's book alludes to one of the best-remembered send-ups of this. It's called Adventures in the Orgasmatron.
there seems to be, in the films of the early 70s, like Woody Allen's Sleeper, in which the orgasmatron obviously plays a central role, and in Barbarella, in which the evil doctor tries to kill someone with pleasure in a orgasmatron, one can detect in these films a certain caution about the idea of the sexual revolution. And the box is an instrument used by an authoritarian regime, you know, in Sleeper. You know, it's part of the substitute satisfaction that is offered by an authoritarian regime. Sex is something that's allowed to repress the masses. So the ideas are kind of inverted and made more complicated in the 70s, I think.
What happens to me is that after I write The Female Eunuch, which has Reichian ideas all the way through it, and I think it was partly because of what was going on in feminism, I suddenly saw that what was happening here was that instead of actually looking at the unjust systems which are oppressing people, you were suddenly looking at yourself and trying to find out what it was in you that made you biddable and obedient. And suddenly liberation became not politics, but religion, a personal discipline that you would follow. And it occurred to me that this was a huge red herring, that it was going to keep a whole generation of people torpid.
But why did Reich's sexual revolution fail?
I think he had a very idealistic view of what liberated sexuality would be like. And we shared that. We absolutely shared it. We thought, if you take away repression, you will get the flower of self-regulating sexuality, which will be gentle, which will be mutually pleasuring, which will be humble, modest. How wrong was that? I mean, that was crazy. Sexuality is like everything else. You know, it's not a redeeming characteristic. And Reich thought it was. We did think that freeing sexuality would be allowing virtue to flower. It was wrong, I think, but it was worth a try.
And yet, the ghost of Reich still haunts our culture. The association between sex and freedom still stands. Few mourn the kind of authoritarian family structures that Reich criticised and dissected. Wilhelm Reich lived one of the great lives of the 20th century. In its first half, he struggled with its most urgent debates, its most powerful forces. In its second half, he was an inspiration for some of its most seismic social shifts. But now he lies buried, alone and largely forgotten, in the woods at Organon.
Oh,
so this is Reich's tomb?
Yeah, and that bust is almost covered up with snow.
The snow has settled so deeply on the tomb that he appears to be peering through it at us. Yeah. And there's a cloud buster.
That was his own.
Yeah. Says Wilhelm Reich, born March the 24th, 1897, died November the 3rd, 1957.
I happen to discover the life energy. I happen to induce Oranor experiment. I know what it means for the future development of medicine and biology, philosophy and natural science. I'm fully aware of it. And in this awareness, I am completely alone. There's no soul anywhere far and wide to talk to give one's feelings, to let one's feelings go freely, to speak like as friends speak to each other. This is all.
The Life and Afterlife of Wilhelm Reich. It was presented by Matthew Sweet and the programme was produced by Phil Tinline. Next week's Sunday feature visits the North Indian city of Chandigarh, commissioned by Nehru in the 1950s and designed by Le Corbusier. Le Corbusier in Chandigarh is next Sunday evening at 9:30, and that's here on BBC Radio 3.
He crossed seas and climbed mountains.
Death holds no fear for me.
struggled through tempests and deserts.
Here's something to feed your dreams.
On his biggest adventure yet.
Are you feeling physical?
A man and a rucksack.
Can't tell you how many wonderful recordings there are now.
In search of the best music in the best recordings every breakfast time.
A perfect balance of intellect and spirit.
BBC Radio 3 Breakfast with Rob Cowan.
Well, I don't know about you, but that certainly set me up for the day.
Weekday mornings from 7.
Pure magic, eh?
This is BBC Radio 3. It's 10:30 and time now for Words and Music, the second of two programmes inspired by Robert Frost's poem Fire and Ice. In this evening's programme about ice, Carolyn Pickles and Alex Jennings will take us flying with the Snow Queen past the vivid blue icebergs of Antarctica and on to Byron's cold, dark vision of the end of the world. There's music by Purcell, Vaughan Williams, Rachmaninoff and Eliza Carthy, as well as poems and prose from Charles Dickens, William Wordsworth, Simon Armitage and Jenny Diski.
Some say the world will end in fire. Some say in ice. From what I've tasted of desire, I hold with those who favour fire. But if it had to perish twice, I think I know enough of hate to say that for destruction ice is also great and would suffice.
My love is like to ice, and I to fire. How comes it then that this her cold so great is not dissolved through my so hot desire, but harder grows the more I her entreat? Or how comes it that my exceeding heat is not allayed by her heart frozen cold, but that I burn much more in boiling sweat and feel my flames augmented manifold? What more miraculous thing may be told, that fire, which all things melts, should harden ice, and ice, which is congealed with senseless cold, should kindle fire by wonderful device? Such is the power of love in gentle mind, that it can alter all the course of kind. Wardle led the way to a pretty large sheet of ice, and the fat boy and Mr. Weller, having shovelled and swept away the snow which had fallen on it during the night, Mr. Bob Sawyer adjusted his skates with a dexterity which to Mr. Winkle was perfectly marvellous, and described circles with his left leg, and cut figures of eight, and inscribed upon the ice, without once stopping for breath, a great many other pleasant and astonishing devices, to the excessive satisfaction of Mr. Pickwick, Mr. Tupman, and the ladies, which reached a pitch of positive enthusiasm when old Wardle and Benjamin Allen, assisted by the aforesaid Bob Sawyer, performed some mystic evolutions, which they called a reel. All this time, Mr. Winkle, with his face and hands blue with the cold, had been forcing a gimlet into the sole of his feet, and putting his skates on, with the points behind, and getting the straps into a very complicated and entangled state. At length, however, with the assistance of Mr. Weller, the unfortunate skates were firmly screwed and buckled on, and Mr. Winkle was raised to his feet. "Now then, sir," said Sam, in an encouraging tone, "off with you and show 'em how to do it."
Thank you.
in the frosty season, when the sun was set, and visible for many a mile the cottage windows through the twilight blazed, I heeded not their summons. Clear and loud, the village clock told six. I wheeled about, proud and exulting, like an untired horse that cares not for his home. All shod with steel, we hissed along the polished ice in games confederate, imitative of the chase and woodland pleasures, the resounding horn, the pack, loud bellowing, and the hunted hare. So through the darkness and the cold we flew, and not a voice was idle. With the din, meanwhile, the precipices rang aloud. The leafless trees and every icy crag tinkled like iron, while the distant hills into the tumult sent an alien sound of melancholy, not unnoticed, while the stars, eastward, were sparkling clear, and in the west the orange sky of evening died away.
Thank you.
I shove up through the old plantation, larch out of season, drab, drained of all greenness, widowed princesses in moth-eaten furs, and stumble out on the lap of the moor. Rotten and rusted, a 5-bar gate lies felled in the mud, letting the fields escape. Winter is late and light this year. Thin snow, half puddled, sun still trapped in the earth. Sludge underfoot all the way to the ridge. And none of the stuff that I came here to find. Except in a high nick at the valley head, where a wet, north-facing lintel of rock has cornered and cupped enough of the wind for running water to freeze. Icicles. Once, I unrooted some 6-foot tusk from the waterfall's crystallized overhang, lowered it down and stood it on end, then stared at an ice age locked in its glassy depths, at far hills bottled in its weird lens. These are brittle and timid and rare, and weep in my gloved fist as I ferry them home. I'd wanted to offer my daughter a taste of the glacier, a sense of the world being pinned in place by a diamond-like cold at each pole. But opening up my hand, there's nothing to pass on, nothing to hold.
Thank you.
The icebergs close up were not daydream white at all. Blue. Icebergs are blue. At their bluest, they are the colour of David Hockney's swimming pools. Californian blue, neon blue, dazz blue, whiteness blue, sometimes even indigo. Blue is an odd colour, the signifier of good things to come. Blue skies, nothing but blue skies, and of dark thoughts, mood indigo. Different shades, different promises, same colour. It can be bright, clean, even cold, and it can be mysterious, deep, the colour of night and dreams. Like Melville's notion of whiteness, it makes clear and it obscures. It is purity and complexity. The colour blue does no violence to my hankering for white. It belonged with and in the ice, making it seem colder, emotionally empty, and yet more dense, layered beyond what could be observed. The bergs were deepest blue at sea level, and where cracks and crevices gave a view of the depths of the berg, where the ice was the oldest, and so compacted that all the air had been forced out. All night they floated along, carved by wind and water into ancient shapes, ships, castles, monuments, mythic creatures.